the US, UK, France, Russia and China, plus Germany.
In fact, after signing the JCPOA, while the United States was reluctant to fulfill its obligations, it expected one to do so unilaterally. And for this reason, the United States expected to disarm Iran through the JCPOA and paralyze Iran's defense capability. And fortunately, the Iranian people and the leader of Iran and the officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran acted very smartly. Although Iran opened all its nuclear facilities to IAEA inspectors and allowed inspections of all Iranian nuclear facilities, the United States did not honor its commitments, proving that it does not adhere to international agreements.
The U.S.'s violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231 is all the more bewildering because it was in fact submitted by the United States itself for the UN Security Council to adopt on 20th July 2015. Besides, it is the first time in UN history that a permanent member of the Security Council punishes UN members for complying with a Security Council resolution.
As a choice.
That's referring to the U.S. threatening other JCPOA signatories with secondary sanctions should they deal with Iran.
Former U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Tony Blinken has made a speech at the Hudson Institute. In any case, Blinken is an influential figure in the Biden campaign who says that we, as Democrats, did not anticipate that maximum pressure campaign could be successful and that the United States could unilaterally rebuild the sanctions system against Iran. He explains now that the pressure campaign has shown results, he must use this achievement. They show that in enmity with Iran, there is not much difference between Trump and Biden, and they differ only in their methods.
The U.S. not just pulled out, but tried to reverse the deal. It all comes across as even more tragically funny when you recall the ultimate idea of the deal was to lift sanctions to boost Iran's foreign trade and economy. And you wonder why Iran mistrusts the U.S. too much even to sit down to talks? The US and Britain overthrew the oil nationalization era Prime Minister Mossadegh in 1953. It's no secret Britain was not pleased with Iran's having nationalized its oil in 1951. And pursuant to that, it enlisted US assistance in orchestrating what's known as a coup to oust Mossadegh.
The problems between Iran and the United States are historical and long-running. The United States has heavily interfered in Iran's internal affairs over the past seven decades, including the 1953 coup against the then-Iranian government, the attack on Tabas during the Operation Eagle Claw, the coup attempt in Iran in the early days of the Islamic Revolution, and Saddam's imposed war on Iran. These are the results of U.S. intervention. And therefore, the United States must first and foremost ensure that it does not interfere in Iran's internal affairs and deals with the Iranian people with respect and show willingness for friendly and mutual cooperation.
Also, the U.S. backed Iraq when it attacked Iran in 1980 and during the eight-year war that followed, costing the lives of 300,000 Iranians and causing more than $1 trillion in damages. The U.S. even stood by when Iraq used chemical weapons against Iranian soldiers and civilians alike. Not just that, it even assisted Iraq with satellite imagery and maps to locate where to hit with its dirty bombs. Even toward the end of the Iraq-Iran War in 1988, the U.S. shot down an Iranian civilian airliner, killing all 290 people on board. Also, Iran was listed on the U.S. Axis of Evil list in 2002 by the then-president, Bush Jr. This was while Iran was one of the first countries to condemn the 9/11 attacks of 2001. Iran then assisted the U.S. in the fight against the Taliban in Afghanistan, rounded up Arabs to counter al-Qaeda, and so forth. And as recently as early January 2020, the U.S. assassinated Iran's General Soleimani and companions in Iraq. And he was a hero in the fight against Daesh or ISIS in Iraq and Syria. There's more to come after a quick look at other media outlets with Shahzad.
Hi, my name is Shahzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on Iran-U.S. relations and challenges amid the post-Trump era. Caspian News reports President Rouhani claims end of maximum pressure by U.S. on Iran. Iranian President Hassan Rouhani has expressed his belief that the era of maximum pressure by the U.S. on Iran has ended amid rumors that President-elect Joe Biden wishes to return Washington to the Iran nuclear deal. There are signs from America to Europe that show the world has understood that maximum pressure will not yield results, and it is coming to an end, Rouhani said, speaking via video conference to mark the inauguration of several national projects on November 11th. Rouhani said that a man, Donald Trump, whose term of office is coming to an end, was provoked from the beginning and left the nuclear deal with childish and delusional ideas. And the new person said that he was ready to return to the JCPOA. It is up to them. If they live up to their obligations, they can choose a new path. The Wire states U.S.-Iran relations. Biden may avert risk of conflict, but long-term plan remains unclear. It seems the only benefit that Biden's presidency might have in the short term is to avert risks of a U.S.-Iran conflict and partial easing of sanctions, so that there will be a slight and temporary improvement in the living condition of the Iranian people. I believe Joe Biden is more likely to pursue Trump's maximum pressure campaign against Iran by keeping the bulk of sanctions to guarantee that Tehran will never get back to the days before the JCPOA agreement, prominent reformist journalist and analyst Abbas Abdi wrote. Meanwhile, Biden is a first-term president who will have many competing priorities on his desk, from domestic issues including the deadly COVID-19 pandemic and an economic crisis, as well as a divided society, plus a hostile Republican Party, as well as the foreign policy issues like the broken ties with Europe that all need his immediate attention. So amid all these problems that have a direct impact on the American people, it remains unclear how much political capital Biden wants to devote to Iran. The Atlantic Council claims optimism and obstacles for U.S.-Iran relations under a Biden presidency. Biden has argued that Iran is a destabilizing actor that should never be allowed to develop nuclear weapons. In September, he pledged to return the U.S. to the JCPOA as a starting point for follow-on negotiations if Iran returns to strict compliance. More recently, a former senior Obama administration official, Amos Hochstein, argued that in the first months of Biden's presidency, we'll either see him rejoin the deal fully, or what I would call JCPOA minus, meaning lifting sanctions in exchange for suspending some of the Iranian nuclear programs developed in the past 3 years. The Biden administration will reach out to its traditional allies, Britain, France, and Germany, as well as the European Union, to rebuild the Obama-era coalition that produced the JCPOA. At the same time, European countries will seek to bridge the gap between Iran and the U.S. elections and Biden's inauguration. In his congratulatory message to the U.S. president-elect, German Foreign Minister Heiko Maas tweeted that we will only be able to solve international challenges if we join our forces. He specifically called on the Biden administration to work closely on Iran. Other European leaders have also expressed the need for renewed cooperation between transatlantic allies. That's all for this segment.
Whether it is safe to even sit down to talks with a country used to 4 years of deal-breaking and 40 years of no dealing with Iran is a question pondered at the highest levels of the system. The leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, has warned any negotiation with the U.S. will have no outcome but material and spiritual harms. He said it in the context of the U.S. pullout from the JCPOA.
اینی که دشمن میگه بیایید مذاکره کنیم یعنی این که بیایید شما
The leader did also acknowledge Iran's own portion of blame for its economic and medical woes with COVID-19 raging on. He said it's not that he believes in cutting off relations with the outside world altogether. His words were, "Relations should be kept in place. The important thing is that we not ask others and foreigners to give us the cure, because the cure exists in us and in the country, an important element of which is increasing production." In other words, solving domestic economic problems does not necessarily depend on the existence or non-existence of sanctions.
In fact, both mismanagement by the government or the system and sanctions by the United States, both of them are the source of problems in Iran. We know that prior to sanctions, Iran's growth rate was very high. It was about 6%, and after that, the growth came to just less than minus 6%. So the impacts of sanctions cannot be ignored. We should accept that these sanctions have a lot of impact.
Iran is a large country with many capacities, including specialized, young and up-to-date manpower. Hence, many analysts, both for and against, attribute the economic backwardness to complex, old-fashioned government bureaucracy and the aging of the government structure. The problem with a dated, all-encompassing bureaucracy is that it leads to the hoarding of wealth and credit and power, and that is recipe for a creeping corruption. It can be prevented by leaving bureaucracy to macro-political matters such as war and peace and foreign affairs, and allowing everyday matters in the hands of citizens and electronic services. Also, the revealing balancing power of the media should not be overlooked in keeping the system and systemic individuals in check. Whatever Iran's portion of the blame, the USA's blame for Iran's economic hardship is its own. Biden will have a lot of practical convincing to do to regain Iranian trust. It won't be easy, given Trump has made sure to make it as hard as possible for his successor to reverse the maximum pressure campaign and progressive sanctions Trump imposed on this country's banking, oil industry, and even partially medicine. That's it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The West is obliged to lift the sanctions against Iran immediately. Imam Khamenei used to address the whole nation on the anniversary of the January 8, 1978, which is 19th of Day Uprising, in the presence of thousands of people from Qom in the Husseiniyah of Imam Khomeini. The U.S. economy is crippled in the true sense of the word. There are tens of millions of unemployed people who suffer from hunger and homelessness. Such is the current situation in the U.S. The U.S. believes its interests lie in creating instability in the region. They state this openly.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want to need. my Lord. Protect me from dishonor. Grant me faith to be stronger.
In the year 1388, which is 2009, the U.S. wished to create instability in Iran, and now this has happened to themselves this year in 1399, which is 2020. In that year, they wished to do in Iran what has happened in Washington, in particular, the events taking place the day before yesterday. Certain individuals poured into the U.S. Congress, and as a result, they had to evacuate the members of Congress through secret passageways. The front of arrogance keeps questioning Iran's presence in the region. However, the Islamic Republic has the duty to behave in such a way as to strengthen its friends and supporters in the region. Our presence leads to stability. It has been proven that the Islamic Republic's presence in the region helps to eliminate the causes of instability, such as the issue of Daesh, ISIS in Iraq, various matters in Syria and the like. However, I do not want to enter into in these details now. Those who are involved in these matters are perfectly aware of this. Therefore, our presence in the region is a definite matter, which should and will continue.
Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
The U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo is to designate Yemen's Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization. The warning, this would exacerbate the humanitarian situation in the country, suffering from all kinds of diseases like malnutrition and famine. Now, in this edition of the debate, we will ask, what is this world coming to when the ones that are being bombed are being sanctioned, while the ones doing the bombing and the killing can go scot-free and get a green pass to continue the siege and the killing.
Saudi Arabia and its allies, backed by the United States, launched a devastating war against Yemen in March 2015 to oust the Ansarullah movement, which took power following the resignation of the country's former president, Abdrabdu Mansour Hadi. The conflict that has so far killed tens of thousands of Yemenis, mostly women and children, has been described by the United Nations as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Nonetheless, in defiance of calls to help end the war, the administration of U.S. President Donald Trump has decided to blacklist the Ansarullah movement. The Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, said the designation will take place on January 19th, the day before President-elect Joe Biden takes office. In a statement, Pompeo accused the movement of terrorist acts, destabilizing the region and obstructing a peaceful solution to the conflict in Yemen. The allegations drew backlash from Yemeni officials.
Taking this decision at this time is the result of great local and international political pressure to stop the war in Yemen. And America is the one that does not want to stop this war and this aggression.
Yemen's Supreme Political Council also branded the United States as a source of terrorism and vowed to respond to its designation move. Iran also condemned the U.S. for branding Ansarullah a terrorist entity.
It's likely the bankrupt U.S. government will do further damage to its reputation in its final days and leave the region with an even more poisonous legacy.
Aid groups also blasted the U.S. blacklisting move, with Oxfam calling the decision a counterproductive and dangerous policy that will put innocent lives at risk. The United States, along with some other Western countries, are major suppliers of weapons to Saudi Arabia. The Trump administration has so far turned a deaf ear to calls from international rights groups and politicians inside the U.S. to halt arms sales to the kingdom. Now the ball is in the court of Joe Biden, who will officially take the helm at the White House on January 20th. It remains to be seen whether he will toe the line of his predecessor towards Yemen or change course.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, radio host and political commentator Eli Joseph James, joins us from Chicago. We also have journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier, who joins us from Brussels. Gentlemen, welcome. Let me first start with you, Elijah Magnier, if I may. We're looking at this sanction that the U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has announced against the Ansarullah movement, and it does consist of three of its leading leaders. Now, Mike Pompeo, months ago, was advised against not doing this, or the Trump administration, but yet it has chosen this time to do it. Why do you think that is? Why do you think this day was the day that it, or this time is the time that it, the announcement was made?
Well, the architect of the Saudi war in Yemen is definitely Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, who has failed to develop a comprehensive strategy because he has no military experience or training. He lacks government management and a necessary intelligence to acknowledge that this is a useless war and far from being considered as a victory. He rather engaged in multiple human rights violations and crimes against humanity and gave an incentive for the Houthi to develop their deterrence. Now, it is the U.S. State Department who is responsible for the designation of foreign terrorist organizations. So the Crown Prince pushed Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in his last 8 days, and Pompeo, who visited Riyadh in the last few months, he pushed him to issue a designation against the Houthi, who never attacked Americans, but fought against Al-Qaeda and against the invaders of their countries. And here we're talking about Saudi Arabia and the Emirates. A foreign terrorist organization designation is definitely a political act. So the Trump administration could have made the technical decision to designate the Houthi anytime in the last 4 years during the Trump administration. Now, under Biden administration, removing the designation is not that easy. It's a difficult political and bureaucratic process. Now, branding the Houthis as terrorists would be an attempt to block Biden and the world from speaking to the Houthi. The reality is the Houthi control most of northern Yemen, and it's better to hold direct talk with them than to live in a denial and ignore their control and presence in Yemen. Now, having direct contact with the Houthi will establish dialogue, direct talk, exchange of prisoners, halt the attacks on both sides, bring to Sana'a humanitarian support. The Saudis are desperate because the new Biden administration said it will block arms delivery to the kingdom and hold Crown Prince accountable for the Yemen war and all the murders that he did, and in particularly the murder of the journalist Jamal Khashoggi 2 years ago in Istanbul. Even if the new administration doesn't hold Mohammed bin Salman to account, it is likely that there will be a cooperation in the Congress. So designing the Houthis as a foreign terrorist organization, it is definitely going to make it extremely difficult, that already difficult situation on the ground. It will neutralize the effort of humanitarian relief organization to get food and medicine to millions of Yemenis.
Let's continue that trend of thought, Eli Joseph James, and ask you, given the fact that the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, was advised from months ago, and as our guest there from years ago, perhaps, if they wanted to designate the group as a terrorist organization, they may have been told this, that, you know, they're going to have a situation humanitarian-wise that's going to get exacerbated. After all, this is the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But given that fact and knowledge that the Secretary of State did have, he still went ahead, or the Trump administration still went ahead with this. Do you think that, why do you think that is? Why would they do this?
Well, let me say first that President Trump has actually been a relative peacemaker while he's been president. The Democratic Party, with Obama, you know, escalated the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, etc. It's Trump who's pulled out troops and has not made any new wars, which has been unusual for American presidents to not engage us in any new wars. However, given the fact that Biden and Hillary Clinton are cut from the same cloth, I would not expect any promises by Biden to be kept on behalf of Yemen and Houthi, none whatsoever. That's just propaganda he's issuing because he wants to curry favor with anybody who doesn't like Donald Trump, okay? Remember, it was Hillary Clinton who orchestrated the assassination of Gaddafi in Libya, and Biden has always been a supporter of Hillary Clinton, so I would not expect 1 ounce of support from Biden except rhetoric. That's all I would expect from Biden. As to why Mike Pompeo has done this, again, I think it's just posturing by people. I don't think Trump wants to get us involved in yet another conflict. And from my perspective, America has pretty much stayed out of this, except for rattling sabers on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the Israelis. But just from my perspective, this is Saudi Arabia's war against Yemen. So the Saudis need to be held accountable for invading a sovereign country. I don't know why they did it, but probably at the behest of the Israelis, whose basic policies in the Middle East is to disrupt every other nation except Israel. That's their basic policy. And because the Zionists have so much power here in America, whatever administration we have is pretty much going to do their will.
Okay. The conclusion, Elijah Magnier, that I'm getting from our guest there, Eli Joseph James, is that the U.S. under President Donald Trump did not engage in a war during his 4 years, and Israel is the one that is interfering or that is somewhat having a hand in all the countries in West Asia, as we call it, or the Middle East. My question would be then, does the U.S. subscribe to provide military equipment via arms sales to countries like Saudi Arabia? Does that make it exempt from not participating in a war like in this case, Yemen, in which, by some accounts, hundreds of thousands have died?
I tend to agree with the half of the answer. So, yes, Israel acted as an advisor to Trump in given it the Syrian Golan Heights, the occupied Syrian Golan Heights, Jerusalem, and Pompeo gave the settlement to Israel. But I fully disagree with your guest when saying Trump did not start a war. Indeed, he has started many wars, because war is not only military, it's also about sanctions. And he starved people in Venezuela, he starved people in Iran, in Syria, in Lebanon. So that is another soft war that is more harmful than a military war. And we saw the war on Iraq, how the Americans defeated Saddam Hussein, but then they couldn't win the war. So they found another way to allow ISIS to occupy the country. So no, Trump also killed General Qasem Soleimani and Abu Mahdi Mohandes. So yes, he made assassinations, and he pushed the whole Middle East to the verge of a very general war that he could start it but not end. On the other hand, in relation to Yemen, the U.S. sold weapons to Saudi Arabia to continue the war on Yemen, and that is a very direct participation to the war crime that the Saudis are committing with U.S. weapons and German and French and the U.K. So there are many participants to this war on Yemen, not directly with many troops on the ground, but there are definitely some U.S. troops guiding the Saudis and offering intelligence, and that is a war that have participated. So it is not right to say the U.S. is not participating to the war on Yemen. It is directly participating to the war, and Trump is responsible for the starvation that's a soft war on many other countries in the Middle East.
Well, Joseph James, I mean, we can't just skim over. I mean, when I asked you the question, you immediately went and talked about how under Obama, so forth and so on, and Biden is a supporter of Clinton. My question to you was about the humanitarian aspect. We can't skip over this. We're looking at the world's worst humanitarian crisis. This move puts humanitarian access at risk. There are people who are not only dying from now COVID-19, they're dying of starvation, famine, all different sorts of diseases. At the same time, what our guest there from Brussels said, it risks future peace talks between the Ansarullah and the opposition. Does the U.S. then want to sabotage perhaps any chance of peace by making this type of announcement?
Well, first let me say I can't argue with anything that Elijah just said in terms of boycotts, because yes, indeed, boycotts are a form of war, right? I was just referring to a military invasion. But yes, the United States government has been in bed with the Israelis since the Six-Day War. And in fact, the Israelis attacked one of our ships, the USS Liberty, and that's been downplayed and even totally suppressed. You know, so the Israelis make war on everybody. They make war on everybody. But as Rothschild banks that run the show in virtually every country in the world, except possibly Iran. I'm not sure if there's any other country that has been resisting the will of the Israeli state and the Zionists who control the world economy. They control the world economy. So if any American president or leader contradicts the will of these Zionists, he's the first one going to be assassinated, as President Kennedy found out. So you can't blame this on the Americans. You have to look at the source. And I think in spite of all that, Trump has been a less aggressive president than anybody else. What I'm trying to say to you and Elijah is expect Biden to be far worse than Trump.
So this leaves us now in a situation where, as you said, Elijah, the Biden administration, I mean, this thing is going to go into effect possibly the 19th of January, a day before President-elect Biden's inauguration. So it's going to leave, kind of pass on the baton to him. What type of approach may we expect from Biden? Will he be proactive, as the news now indicates, for example, today, where key U.S. lawmakers actually urged a quick reversal of this? And I'm going to quote, "The designation of the Ansarullah as a terrorist organization is a death sentence for thousands of Yemenis," coming from Senator Chris Murphy.
Unfortunately, we can no longer trust what the president or president-elect or president candidates are saying. We saw what Obama said before the elections, and we saw what Trump said before the elections, and now we hear what Biden is saying prior to the election. So there are many talks today within the U.S. administration, and many talks of the presidential candidates that they change their mind once they are in power. And we see Biden may have priorities like China, like Russia, like the nuclear deal with Iran, and perhaps Yemen is not on top of his list, as well as the withdrawing from Iraq or from Syria, or leaving Lebanon alone to sort out its own problem. So basically, we can't really trust what Biden is going to do, and we don't have to give a lot of weight to what he said against the Saudis and that he's going to stop the war in Yemen. Definitely we can come out with the conclusion that Pompeo is doing everything he can to put pressure and to slow down any process the new Biden administration may have think to do in the future to remove all these sanctions, because, I mean, the guy is not stopping. Every single day in the last 20 days, he's coming out with a new sanction. So what Biden is going to do is really unclear, and how much time he needs to undo all these obstacles that Pompeo is putting in front of him, or perhaps benefit from these already imposed sanctions and are in place to say, hey, I didn't do it, that's Trump, and I need time to undo everything. So personally speaking, I cannot trust the Biden administration and say this guy is going to come and make changes. He had the domestic first, he had the relationship with the allies that are spoiled, and then he has China, Russia, etc. So no, I don't think the war on Yemen, the criminal and devastating war on Yemen is going to stop in one day or in one month even.
Well, let's try to figure out, Eli Joseph James, what this war is all about. I mean, maybe you can tell us. Do you know what this war is all about?
Well, yes. I'm not sure. All I know is that the Saudis invaded Yemen, right? Not the other way around. And as you said at the very beginning, it's the victims who are being blamed for the crisis, when the crisis, when the big bully in the Middle East there is Saudi Arabia. They're the big bully. And as I have stated many times here at Press TV, the Saudis are puppets of the Israelis, and they do the will of the Israelis without question. So, and they're using the Saudis to destabilize the rest of the countries in the Middle East. That's what they're doing, especially Iran. We know what they did to Iraq, but they've pitted Iraq against Iran in a war and elevated Saddam Hussein. Then they stabbed him in the back and made war against him. So this is the only kind of activity you can expect. And unfortunately, our government is so weak vis-a-vis the Zionist power. And of course, from the UN, because the UN is just another paper tiger in terms of how they approach these issues. Yeah, okay, so they may condemn the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, but what are they going to do? They're not going to do anything, because the Rothschilds created the UN, the Rothschilds created the Israeli state, and really what needs to happen is the other Middle East countries, when there used to be an oil cartel, or we called an oil cartel, of people against the Rothschild money power, they need to reorganize against that same power and put pressure on them somehow. I don't think that they can organize a war against Iran, although they've been threatening that for the longest time. But the other Arab country, Arab and other countries in the Middle East need to join against this power called the Israeli state. None of this is going to stop until we do that.
Okay, my final question then goes to you. In Brussels, Elijah Magnier, there are some who have said that if this war was to stop, it could be done with one phone call from the U.S. to Saudi Arabia. Do you think that is the case, that the U.S. could actually stop this war with one phone call to Saudi Arabia?
I think so, yes, because the Trump revealed many realities during his administration. He said to the Saudis, you would not last for 1 week without my protection. And he said, if you stay for 2 weeks, you will start speaking Farsi. Therefore, when the Americans put pressure on the Saudis to reconcile with Qatar, that was done from one day to another. And Saudi Arabia is just a kingdom that is imposing itself on the Saudis population, because it had the Americans behind it, supporting it. And the Americans, obviously what Trump said, because he said many truths, he doesn't want to lose them. He doesn't want to lose their money. So the day the Americans decide to stop this war, I don't think it will require more than 24 hours. But the Americans are benefiting from this war. As long as it lasts and continues, so are the Europeans. So there are many people benefiting from the misery of the Yemeni and the famine that they are going through, and the killing of over 45,000 Yemeni in the useless 6 years of war, just because Yemen and Sana'a decided in 2015 that there will be direct flight between Sana'a and Tehran, and that the Iranians have access to the port of Hodeidah. That's it. The Yemenis are not allowed to have relationship with Iran and decide their fate, and they have to remain as servants to the backyard of the Saudis.
Okay, we're going to end it there. Thank you very much. Let me thank our guests, radio host and political commentator, Ellie Joseph James from Chicago, and journalist and political analyst Elijah Magnier. Thank you. Spoke to us from Brussels. That does it for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Tahweh and the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
According to a new national survey conducted by Vox and Data for Progress, 63% of likely voters, including 81% of Democrats, 67% of Independents, and just 32% of Republicans, believe Trump is either very much or somewhat to blame for the right-wing invasion of the Capitol building, which led to the death of 6 people. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading, "No, not totally appropriate." Poll shows 63% in U.S. blame Trump for insurrection. Here's the details. Shortly after President Donald Trump on Tuesday, January 12th, characteristically refused to accept any responsibility for inciting the mob of his supporters that attacked the U.S. Capitol last week, new polling showed that nearly two-thirds of likely U.S. voters believe the lame duck incumbent is directly to blame for the deadly violence. According to a new national survey conducted by Vox and Data for Progress, 63% of likely voters, including 81% of Democrats, 67% of Independents, and just 32% of Republicans believe Trump is either very much or somewhat to blame for the right-wing invasion of the Capitol building, which led to the death of 6 people. A majority of likely U.S. voters believe Republican lawmakers, specifically Senators Ted Cruz and Josh Hawley, share some of the blame for inciting the mob attack on Congress as lawmakers moved to certify Joe Biden's decisive Electoral College victory. Speaking to the press on Tuesday, January 12th, during his first in-person public appearance since last Wednesday attack, Trump expressed no regret for the unhinged speech he delivered just before his supporters invaded the halls of Congress and claimed that people thought what I said was totally appropriate. The president didn't specify who thought his speech, which was packed with deranged lies about the election, was perfectly acceptable. Trump's comments to reporters on Tuesday, January 12th, came as the president is facing a likely second impeachment on at least one charge of inciting insurrection against the U.S. government. The Vox Data for Progress poll released on Tuesday, January 12th, found that 51% of the likely U.S. voters believe Trump should be impeached for his role in attempting to overturn the result of 2020 presidential election and inciting riots that led to the storming of the Capitol building. Senator Jeff Merkley tweeted on Tuesday, January 12th, that Trump's speech last week openly incited insurrectionists to storm the Capitol. Today, he called those comments totally appropriate. He is continuing to encourage insurrection and undermining the rule of law, Merkley added. He must be held to account for attacking our Constitution and our country. President Donald Trump on Monday, January 11th, rejected personal responsibility for his comments, widely seen as inciting the violent January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. The speech he made to the extremist crowd has been analyzed. Trump told reporters at Joint Base Andrews, and people thought that what I said was totally appropriate. Progressive group individuals also firmly rejected the president's assessment. Trump's treasonous behavior cannot go unpunished, the group tweeted. Tell your members of Congress to impeach, convict, and disqualify him from ever holding federal office again. The president's remarks to the crowd last week, which including telling them that you will never take back our country with weakness and reiterating false claims of a stolen election, were cited on Monday, January 11th, in a criminal complaint that accuses Trump of sedition. "We're going to impeach this fascist again," said Representative Bill Pascrell in direct response to Trump's remarks. "And when he's out of office in 8 days, he must be prosecuted for his many, many crimes," he added. Meanwhile, Representative Jamal Bowman on Tuesday, January 12th, introduced a bill that seeks to establish a commission to investigate last week's violent assault on the U.S. Capitol by an insurrectionary pro-Trump mob. On Sunday night, Bowman, a freshman Democrat from New York, posed a series of questions on social media. What the hell happened on January 6th? Why were terrorists able to get into the Capitol? Why were they able to walk out free? Why wasn't Congress more prepared for this attack? We need answers, Bowman said, adding that he would soon be introducing a bill to demand a 9/11-style commission to investigate. In a tweet accompanying his introduction of the Congressional Oversight of Unjust Policing, Bowman explained that The purpose of the bill is to establish an investigation into any further ties between Capitol Police and white supremacy, insurrectionism, or fascism. The introduction of Bauman's bill coincides with the emergence of several troubling details surrounding the attack on the Capitol. As of Tuesday afternoon edition of Capitol Hill newsletter, Punch Bowl News reported, "It's clear that the people paid to protect the legislative branch and its workers failed. The U.S. Capitol Police either ignored or were unprepared for the intensity of the attack, and law enforcement agencies are not providing the public with any information." The Washington Post, which obtained and reviewed an internal document, reported recently that the day before rioters stormed Congress, an FBI office in Virginia issued an explicit internal warning that extremists were preparing to travel to Washington to commit violence and war, a revelation that contradicts a senior official's declaration. The Bureau had no intelligence indicating anyone, at least, weak pro-Trump protest plan to do harm. According to the Washington Post, as of January 5, 2021, FBI Norfolk received information indicating calls for violence in response to unlawful lockdowns to begin on January 6, 2021 in Washington, D.C., the document says. An online threat discussed specific calls for violence to include stating, "Be ready to fight. Congress needs to hear glass breaking, doors being kicked in, and blood from their BLM and Pantifa slave soldiers being spilled. Get violent. Stop calling this a march or rally or a protest. Go there ready for war. We get our president or we die. Nothing else will achieve this goal." The warning is the starkest evidence yet of the sizable intelligence failure that preceded the mayhem, which claimed the lives of five people, although one law enforcement official, speaking on the condition of anonymity to avoid disciplinary action, said the failure was not one of the intelligence but of acting on the intelligence. Multiple law enforcement officials have said privately in recent days that the level of violence exhibited at the Capitol has led to difficult discussions within the FBI and other agencies about race, terrorism, and whether investigators failed to register the degree of danger because the overwhelming majority of the participants at the rally were white conservationists, fiercely loyal to the President Trump.